All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. If you listen to the Yahoo chapter episodes that I released many months ago, then you'll remember that in those I made the claim that, frankly, a lot of people make. One of the main reasons that Yahoo ended up as the king of the dot-com era search sites was because of its zany, friendly, ubiquitous brand. And the woman responsible for building that brand was Karen Edwards. In today's episode, we're going to talk with Karen and hear how she recounts becoming the first dot-com company to advertise on TV, seeking out, quote, near surfers, and marketing an internet company in an era where many people still didn't even know what the internet was. I know you're going to enjoy this great conversation with the master marketer and brander, Karen Edwards of Yahoo. Karen Edwards, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We always start with a little bit of background. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Southern California. Mm-hmm. Went to Stanford and Harvard Business School, and I worked in my career in marketing consumer products and for companies like 20th Century Fox and mm-hmm. Apple Computer.
Let's go into some of those. So you get a BA in communications at Stanford, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so your first job is at BBDO, the big advertising agency.
Yep. Yeah. Actually, when I was at Stanford, I was very interested in how consumers and technology interact. And there was a program in those days called Values, Technology, and Society. And I think nowadays there are like things you can major in at schools like Stanford, but that have that cross between technology and consumers, but in society. So I was interested in things like history of the future and history of science and things like that. And so I studied a lot about what at that time was the personal computer industry, and ended up then sort of being somewhat qualified to go work in advertising for Apple.
Right, because at BBDO, you're the account manager for Apple's advertising.
Yeah, I was a junior. I mean, my title was like senior account executive, but that's a relatively junior role. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of where I cut my teeth in the beginning of my career.
And what years would that be?
So I was there from about, 1986 till the end of 1988. And that was the time when John Sculley had taken over as CEO.
Right.
And so BBDO was the ad agency that John Sculley had been comfortable with Pepsi in his prior days, whereas Steve Jobs had kind of made this little small creative agency called Chiat Day famous because of all the very iconic advertising that which they did for Apple, like 1984 and some other things. So when John Sculley decided to, or when he became in power, he decided to take over with this new ad agency. And I actually have an anecdote that's kind of funny about that, which was
great.
I got fired from my very first job out of Stanford, which is a long story. I won't go into that. But while I was busy trying to pay off my student loans, I was a waitress at a restaurant here in Silicon Valley called MacArthur Park. And I had really struggled after being, it's kind of demoralized when you get fired from your first job. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what was it that I really wanted to do. And so I finally realized I wanted to go work in a bigger company where I could get some training and I could. And so I thought about, like, what kind of company? And I thought, okay, an ad agency. I really want to work in an ad agency. So I started subscribing to, like, Adweek and Brandweek and all these, Advertising Age. And the days before the Internet, I'm going to the library to look up, what accounts are with what companies and, what are the general principles of advertising and who are the major thought leaders in advertising and so on. So anyway, one day I'm at my day job, which is waitressing, and a group of guys come in, actually, and one lady, and they're ordering red wine in the middle of the day, and they're all in suits, and I'm thinking, wow, this is kind of interesting. What brings you here? What are you guys doing here? And I said, oh, well, we just got finished with a very extensive long pitch for some new business. Oh, well, good luck. I hope that works out. What kind of business are you guys in? We're in advertising. Great. Wow. Well, I would like to work in advertising or whatever. I don't know exactly what I said. And they said, well, we're pitching the Apple computer account. And I said, well, I actually know quite a bit about Apple. I wrote my honors thesis in this values, technology, and society thing and at Stanford, and I'm very interested in both Apple and in advertising. So anyway, I continued to bring their drinks and their food and their french fries and whatever else, and they said, you know what, if we get the business, we'll hire you. And they did. And so that's how I got my start in advertising and marketing.
That's one of the most serendipitous stories I've ever heard. Wow.
Yeah. So I was really lucky because I was at a world-class agency with, an amazing brand. And so I kind of got a jump start, whereas I was prepared to have to start as maybe like as a secretary or as a, administrative assistant or something, but that was kind of a big leapfrog for me in my career. Yeah.
Well, so then you do go get your MBA at Harvard Business School.
Uh-huh.
And so after that, you're a brand manager with Clorox.
Right. And I really like that. And I do think that a lot of the things I learned there helped me in marketing from a more analytical perspective. Also, Clorox has an amazing culture in terms of grooming people to be leaders. So I think everything that I learned in terms of managing people and teams, and I think I learned there. Yeah.
And so then there's a couple years where you're with 20th Century Fox.
So I went to 20th Century Fox. I worked first in the U.S. I really liked marketing. I realized, okay, I'm a marketer. I know it's in my blood. But there's got to be something better than bleach. And so I decided to move to, I really was interested in the entertainment industry. I kind of missed sort of the adrenaline that went on with, like, the advertising world and, computers and fast moving industry. So I decided to work in the entertainment industry, moved to L.A., and I worked in the home video, what was in those days, videos that were often rented in stores, like a huge brand called Blockbuster that many people don't even remember who they were anymore. We used to sell, videos at places like Walmart and Target and Kmart, before the days of DVDs and Netflix and so on. So I did that for a couple of years in the U.S., and then I had the opportunity to work in a more general management role running those businesses, the home video businesses in France, Spain, and Italy. And so that was really useful for my Yahoo career because Pretty much as soon as I joined Yahoo, just within a few months, we were expanding internationally. So I was very fortunate that I had had, you know, some international experience. You know, mostly in France, Spain, and Italy, where I was based for about 2 years. But I also had the opportunity to work in a little bit in the the console game business that Fox had. You know, like all the video games that related to Aliens and a bunch of other film properties. So I was able to learn a little bit about that, which sort of got me kind of indirectly interested in internet stuff.
Well, that, yes. So, I mean, I want to now know the story of getting hired at Yahoo. I was curious, maybe because you do have, you had lived in the Valley, were you maybe aware that you know, the web revolution was happening? How did you come to get hired at Yahoo?
So this is another one of those serendipitous sort of stories. So I was at 20th Century Fox, and I was at a point where I needed to either commit to another 4-year contract. I was under contract, or I needed to kind of figure out what I was going to do next. It was sort of a transition time at the company, and to be honest, I wasn't all that keen on some of the dynamics in Hollywood, but also I realized I was at a time where it would make sense to kind of take on more leadership or do something slightly different. So, but I was fortunate because I got involved in a couple of task force at the News Corp level. So News Corp being the parent company of 20th Century Fox.
Right.
News Corp at the time owned a competitor to AOL called Delphi, which nobody's heard of nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But, and they also were trying to do some interactive things, and it was all smoke and mirrors, frankly. News Corp didn't really have a clear idea of what it was doing. I was looking at the internet. I was also looking in those days at virtual worlds, which was kind of like the precursor to things like Second Life and InView, which is kind of ironic because I'm now on the board of InView. And I also was looking at a thing called interactive TV, which in those days was absolutely nothing. It was complete smoke and mirrors. But it's kind of the promise is finally being delivered. Like if you think about what Comcast is like today, it's kind of what the internet interactive TV promise was of the 90s. I got frustrated every time I applied for jobs in virtual worlds or interactive TV and got turned down. But thank goodness I did get turned down, because then as I was cold calling internet companies, I cold called Netscape. I had a classmate of mine from business school was one of the founders of CNET. In those days, CNET was mostly a television focused thing, but I was interested in that. I thought maybe with my entertainment background, I might have a chance there. I got turned down there. I tried applying with an interactive advertising agency, got turned down there. And there was this thing called Amazon that was just getting started. they were going to try to sell books online. I didn't really want to move to Seattle, but plus nobody seemed to return my calls from there. If you can imagine, this is the days before everybody had email, right? So literally a lot of this contact is by phone, fax. Some of it is literally handwritten, or typed, printed notes that you put in, the U.S. Postal Service. I'm in Paris. It's a long story, but I was in Paris shopping the flea market. And I met this woman who worked in the Valley in software. And then we hung out a little bit. And then when we got back to California, she introduced me to somebody who introduced me to somebody who introduced me to somebody who knew the name of the new guy who had just been hired at Yahoo to be the new CEO. I remember looking in the newspaper and stuff like that, very little information about this little company called an organization from Stanford. It was a .edu site that had just become a .com, and had just gotten some funding. And there was a guy named Tim Kugel who had been hired as CEO. And then there was this new guy called named Jeff Mallett. And I was told by somebody, now that's the guy you need to write to. So I did. So I typed out a letter and put it in the mail and sent it. And then, you know, I somehow managed to get a phone number to track them down or whatever. And I think at the time there were about 10 people working at the company, 9 or 10 people. And I basically said, you know, I don't know if you have a marketing person or thinking about marketing, but, you know, I'd like to do that for you guys. And I came in, I interviewed actually with Tim Brady, who's spoken with, and Jeff Mallett, who became my boss. And I'm not even sure if I think I did talk to Jerry Yang as well. And I talked to everybody, but I can't remember if initially I did, but I remember just saying, you know, I really think that you guys should think about Yahoo as a brand. Think, you know, and they're like, interesting. Yeah, interesting. Okay. And I said, yeah. And I think the kind of thing I like to do, I think we could really make Yahoo a household name. And I remember Jerry Yang laughing. He's like, a household name? You know, like that. And I was like, well, yeah, no, really. So anyway, I signed up with them. I started to fulfill my contract at Fox. I joined a couple months later. And I joined, I think, like January 1st, 1996, which several of us, I would say 6 or 7 of us started that same day. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure what number employee I am. So I usually, just to be on the safe side, I say I'm like the 17th employee, but mm-hmm. to be honest, I don't really know. I'm somewhere in the team, the, you know, low to mid-teens. So I just say I'm the 17th, which is probably somewhere close.
But, well, the point is that it's still, they're probably fresh, recently out of Stanford. they're literally starting up as a real company. So actually, I'd be curious to know, give me your impressions of what Yahoo is like when you join it.
So when I first saw Yahoo, it was this, it had a gray screen. It was all text. It had it had this kind of like Velveeta cheese and brick red colored logo in this funky weird script at the top with these little buttons that said things like what's cool, what's new, and then maybe something like news and whatever. There was a search bar and a button that said search. But in those days, the Yahoo, what it was a directory. So we had people would submit, have you already talked about this?
Yeah, a little bit, but go ahead.
Okay, so it was a directory, meaning there were live human beings, which we called surfers, and we had a small team of them in those days. They were headed up by a woman that we referred to as Ninj. And she had started in the early days with Jerry and David creating this ontological hierarchy of how to organize information, organize data. So, for instance, you know, there's all kinds of different ways one could think about categorizing a website, right? Like, so, for instance, a classic one that we often, you know, had issues with or whatever was Jews for Jesus. Does that go under Judaism? Does that go under Christianity? Does that go under, you know, religious, you know, institutions? Where does that go, right? So, you know, nowadays, if everything's automated, you would just, you know, nobody has to ask that question, right? But in those days, you had to actually think about, well, where would somebody expect to find it, right? Would be one way we might answer. And then, of course, things could be under multiple different places, but you know, somebody had to answer that question. So the way it worked was, in those days, you know, people were creating websites that had broken links and that were crap. And so if you created a website, you would submit it to Yahoo and to some other search places, Excite and Like Us, where you would submit your website through a form to Yahoo, and Yahoo would decide whether or not to even place it in Yahoo or not. And it would decide to where it would go. And so initially, that's what Yahoo was this directory. Then on top of that, we had just a search of the web. So if you typed in the name of something you were interested in on Yahoo, you would first at the top see the Yahoo sort of sanctioned, if you will, listing.
Categories,
and
right.
then if there was nothing, if but then it, let's say you were looking for something that was not already in Yahoo, not in the directory, then it would just start doing searches throughout the World Wide Web and the Internet more broadly in those days. So which would quite often yield a bunch of junk. So it would not be very helpful. It was like looking for like a needle in a haystack. Because what you really wanted was, you know, you're about to buy a new car. You really want the Honda.com website. Because you want to see what Honda has to say. Honda happened to be one of those brands in the early days that really invested early in the Internet. And so I'm just using them as an example because they were a great car company website. But if you looked up, let's say, Hyundai in those days, which hadn't invested in a website and didn't have a bunch of cool stuff yet, then you would just get a bunch of messy stuff where anytime Hyundai was mentioned, like safety things or the SEC filings or import duties and regulations around Korea or whatever, right? And which is not what you wanted. You're just trying to buy a car, right?
Right.
So that was the value we were adding, which was making sense of the Internet, organizing the Internet, and presenting it in a way that people could get to it quickly. The other thing is, because the Internet was so new, the World Wide Web was so new, it was like some people were just like, show me what's new. Like, what are some cool new websites? Who's doing give me an example of what a cool website is, right? And so we used to have these little sunglasses icon. This predates me. It was not my idea.
I remember very well, though.
I sometimes thought it was kind of hokey, but people seemed to love it at the time. But we would put little, like, cool, it would say cool or have, like, little sunglasses to indicate it was cool. And we did that for, you know, the websites that actually were useful, you know, and we would talk to, we would try to help promote the things because it was like, okay, a lot of people don't even know why they would bother using the Internet. Like people would say, you know, I don't really need the Internet. Like, why would I need it? You know, and you'd say, well, because there's some really cool websites. Like, what? And so then we felt that was partly our job, help people see that there's some cool stuff to do.
And also, because I'm sorry to interrupt, but I feel like if I understand the chronology correctly, again, this is sort of right when they've left Stanford and they've decided to try to make a real company out of this. So did you also get the sense of they're figuring stuff out? They're trying to figure out how to become a real company?
Absolutely. So when I first started talking to them in my early days of working there, we were located in a industrial park, like next to some like auto body mechanic shops, you know, like, mm-hmm. like if you've driven through kind of like those sorts of places where it's like, you know, mechanics, auto body,
right.
detailing, whatever, things like that. So, and inside, like there were these people cataloging the websites. There was a guy named Dave Shen who was looking at trying to improve the UI, the user interface as best as he could. And, graphic, and we used the GUI guy, and we were thinking about by the time I actually joined the company in January, from so the difference between say November until January, we started to receive some investment from companies like Ziff Davis and SoftBank. So at that point, we started thinking like, is there an opportunity to be more of like a content company where we focus on some key vertical areas like sports, finance, news, and start, because we were realizing like, yeah, people don't really know where to even begin with this Internet stuff. Like, okay, you know, what do you, like people do, but why do I need it? Like, why would I use it, the Internet? Like, and this is also like email, but I don't really want people to email me. And what if, you know, somebody gets my email address or whatever. I mean, that was how most people thought of it. I mean, the Internet was like, people thought of it as like, this is just something for geeky people who follow Star Trek or whatever, and are who totally are super deep and interested in things like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff, because there wasn't much mainstream content available. I mean, there was starting to be. I mean, but in the early, I mean, by this time for sure there was. There's plenty of content available, but the average person in the United States was not using it yet. It was really a very early adopter thing. So the content was there. There was like Encyclopedia Britannica, Smithsonian Institute, brands like Honda. There was a famous brand story of this brand called Zima. It was like a malt liquor, malt beverage thing.
Right, right, right.
It was one of these brands that got launched on the internet. I don't even know if it exists anymore. So it was starting to be seen as this new thing, a new phenomenon that was very, very a service and things that was for early adopters. And to keep in mind, like, the way people got onto the internet was that AOL, was starting to... a lot of people who were using AOL were getting to the internet through AOL, or they were getting to the internet through services like CompuServe or Prodigy. And these were services that had their own content and their own communities and chat rooms and their own news services and their own, like, they didn't call them websites, but they were called, I think, maybe like channels, And so for people who, for the people who like that kind of stuff already, there were already people, using the dial-up modems to use those kinds of services. I did. I had used all of those, actually. It was like, well, but why would you venture out onto the internet? That seems scary, So we were trying to help people make that step, kind of the way that we did it, it was the way I thought about it from as a marketer, was that, kind of no matter what it is that you're into, Yahoo's going to help you find it. And so we focused more on talking to the people. So companies like Netscape, Lycos, Excite, AltaVista, InfoSeek, these were all Silicon Valley or elsewhere tech-based companies run by people with technology backgrounds. And they just figured the fastest search, the best search, the most accurate search was going to be the most important thing. And I think we started to believe, or clearly I believe, that having a brand and being the place that people can start with the internet was going to be very important and very valuable. And I think our human touch, the directory that I was describing before with the surfers who organize the websites and make sure that all the websites that are in Yahoo work and, deliver a good experience, those two things were really critical to differentiating Yahoo from all the other, what appear to be like search engines or, directory kinds of things of the time.
So you, from day one, you determined that to make Yahoo into a household name, like you said, you told Jerry you were going to do, the focus would be on, we're the friendly guide, we're your friendly path onto the internet to educate people, but also give them a home that they could come back to on the web.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say, oh, from the very beginning I knew that, but unfortunately I didn't. It took some time to really think about, like, okay, what's the job here? Like, what is it? What would make a difference? Like, how can we stand out? How can we be the brand of choice, right? Because we weren't really ahead of these other companies. Maybe a little bit. Like, in those days, it was impossible to measure even how large the audience was or how many users we had. We didn't really know. We had a little bit of a sense that kind of who was who, Excite, Lycos, InfoSeek, and so on. But we didn't really know. There was no tracking services. There were no analytics. There were no research companies, doing all this. In fact, that was part of our job, was we started trying to work with research companies and say, hey, why don't you start following this industry? Why don't you help, create some metrics and create some, which You know, so I think I was fortunate because I feel like some of the things I learned in the media business helped with that. Also, my boss, Jeff Mallett, he had a media background as well in the cable industry in Canada. So we valued knowing, like, okay, how many people are really using this? You know, so we wanted to know. In those days, we would sometimes people would refer to hits, like. And that was kind of irrelevant because hits were just like how many hits did the
server get?
Yeah, but somebody could just sit there, you know, hitting, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's a person doing something meaningful. So that is actually something that you know, I feel like if thinking about like the history of the internet, like imagine a world where there was no way to know what was going on. You know, like how many people were using things, how long were they using something? There were, you know, there was no login. You didn't log in with a name and a username and an ID or anything. So nobody knew who you know. We didn't know who anybody was or where they were coming from. Anything. There was such a thing. You know, and there still is an IP address. We can see unique IP addresses. But even that was difficult because in those days, you know, a lot of people were coming in through. Their work, right? And so, because most people at home had dial-up, you know, slow internet connections.
Right.
So we knew that a lot of people were using the internet at work, but that was difficult to track because of the way IP addresses are. So in any case, it was sort of like, yeah, we had kind of like a few jobs. One was like, hey, let's make sure people know that the internet itself is valuable, not, and they don't just stay stuck with these like dedicated online services like AOL, CompuServe, Prodigy, Delphi, where people paid their $9.95 a month or whatever, $19.95 a month. It was like we were saying, hey, you know, if you use their services, also go on the internet, or, you know, you don't really need their services to go to the internet or whatever. But like, once you're on the internet, Yahoo's where you need to start.
Mm-hmm.
Yahoo is going to be your easy, friendly, welcoming place to get started. And so, I mean, like, you know, I wish I could say, yeah, I knew that from the beginning or whatever, but mm-hmm. you know, it took some time to figure out. And I fairly quickly, after just only a few months, I hired a great ad agency that was also just starting up. It was four guys that didn't even have an office yet.
Was that Black Rocket?
Furniture. Black Rocket, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I hired these guys, and we spent a lot of time talking to consumers and talking to people who weren't on the internet, asking them like what were their fears, why would they maybe use it, or people who had just started using the internet, why, you know, what is it about it? Why did you want to do it? The other thing that I did immediately as soon as I got there is I started reading like customer emails and complaints, like what were people happy about and what were people concerned about, and I would just read read all the customer service emails, you know, as many as I could every day to see what was going on. So like I said, there was no data, there was no research reports, there was nothing, you know, which I think could be frustrating if you're a Harvard MBA and worked in packaged goods. But on the other hand, I'd worked in entertainment and advertising, so I was used to having kind of ambiguous sort of having to make decisions more from an intuitive standpoint.
Well, you know, I also think we should give credit here because you know, web companies, internet companies are, as an industry, are only a couple years old at this point, but you guys are really the first to think about these things in terms of branding an internet company, in terms of doing things like considering running television ads, you know?
Right. So the big aha or the big breakthrough in thinking was when we realized that the opportunity was not about getting you know, how do we get the biggest market share amongst internet users? That wasn't it. It was more like, how do we get that next generation of people, the people who aren't even thinking about the internet, to know us, to know Yahoo? So just generating awareness so that when somebody does finally get around to thinking about the internet, and considering it, that they'll know our name first. And so that was the goal. And so it was a very, very clear goal. That's what we did.
How much of a help was just the name Yahoo? Because I mean, go ahead.
It was huge, and that's why I cold called them as opposed to InfoSeek or Site or Lycos, AltaVista.
Because having that as your name, it sort of infer you assume a certain level of, I don't know, this is fun, this is zany, you know what I mean? Like it seems a little more friendly even than something like Excite, you know.
Yes, but it cut, in those days it cut both ways. I mean, nowadays having a clever name in the internet space or even the tech space is considered, you know, kind of sexy and fun. In those days, it also carried a little bit of a tinge of, you know, unreliability, and it's, you know, like, can I really trust these guys? Who? What? Is Yahoo's out there? What the heck? Right? It's like, I'm going to give, like, you know, I'm going to be, like, you know, I could get hacked, right? Like, the word hacker was just starting to come out, right? Didn't even know what hacker was. But then people would go, oh, I might be hacked. And so, like, what about that? These Yahoos? What? Huh? You know? So we knew we couldn't be too, I mean, we did play up the irreverence because we thought, like, hey, the good news is that people do, when they hear the name and they see what we do, they do get a smile on their face. But we realized too that we needed to be careful to not appear just crazy, you know. And one of the things that I think happened is that so we started doing advertising, as you mentioned, on television. It was really interesting how smart we were, really, and I say we, the agency was, in terms of making our television campaign look a lot bigger than it really was. We ended up not spending as much money as we thought we originally would be able to. Mm-hmm. We had a bunch of business obligations that we needed to do and other things that were going on with the business. And so the marketing budget I thought I was going to have at the beginning turned out to be, you know, a fourth of what I thought I was going to have. So, but we have all these big ideas. So we figured, okay, how do we still do some of these ideas anyway? And one of the things the ad agency did is we looked at running our television commercials at places for, you know, actually just in certain cities, not the whole country. And we advertised on shows where we really thought that what we called near surfers, if you can believe it, we used to still use the term surfers to refer to people who were online. We would, what we call near surfers, people who are almost ready to get online. And so we looked at, like, what were some of the most popular television show websites. So The Simpsons, The X-Files, a bunch of these shows that have been around, you know, for a while, Star Trek things, you know, some of these kinds of shows. And we advertised in those programs. And so we looked a lot bigger than we really were, frankly, and in terms of a marketing presence. We, you know, we did that. We did a lot of PR. We did just fun things, like we would go to like street fairs and microbrewery festivals and wine and food festivals, and we would have like some of our employees, you know, setting up computers with, you know, dial-up modems and stuff, and people would walk by and they'd go, look, honey, it's the internet. You know, like, you know, then they'd be like, wow, you know, we haven't seen the internet before. You know, it was just like a completely, it's so hard to imagine, right? But that's what it was like. And people would say, well, why are you guys at, you know, like beer festivals? Why are you at rock concerts? Why are you at, you know, like we used to have like posters that we would put up, you know, kind of like that looked like nightclub postings. You know, we would have our, you know, Yahoo, like, you know, print ads, kind of made as posters that were, you know, around in like urban settings and stuff like that.
Well, that makes me think of two specific branding questions. One being the decision to go with purple, and the other being the decision to go with the tagline "Do you Yahoo?"
Sure. So, and the Yahoo, the yodel that came with that.
Right.
It was so part of it was like we definitely recognized that the name itself was a hook. So, you know, we wanted, you know, some kind of tagline, some sort of thing. You know, when you don't have a lot of money and you don't have a lot of time, it's good if you can have things that you can repeat within all of your communication, so that you're not having to start from scratch in a conversation with your audience every time, right? So having that iconic, you know, the name and the in this case, the do you Yahoo, there's like a slight pause when he says it. It was like a little bit cheeky, kind of. It sounds like a little bit like like you're almost like the person's kind of hesitating before they ask.
Wink, wink, nudge.
And it was kind of like an invitation, like, are you doing this? You know, and kind of like, implying, you know, you should. And so, you know, what we were trying to do, you know, with the advertising is, you know, we our very first ad, we showed an old gentleman who's out at a pond. He's trying to catch fish. He's not having any luck. And then you see him, you know, in the evening on his computer, and he goes onto Yahoo, types in the word bait, and then the next scene is he's holding this big, gigantic, like 500-pound tuna, you know, and laughing, and then there's the do you Yahoo, and then there's Yahoo, and that was the same format that we used in all of our television advertising for like several years. But like, so it was like 30 seconds, but everything that we did was really intentional. So for instance, like we picked an old guy, right? So we're basically saying anybody can do this. An old man can do this. A guy, humble older gentleman, you know, without a fancy house or fancy whatever, just a simple desk. He can, anybody with a computer can do this. And then we also were trying to show it doesn't really matter what your issue is or what you're interested in finding, you can find anything. And then the big gigantic fish is, you know, and you're going to be amazed with the results. You're going to get above and beyond your expectations. And you can count on us to deliver, right? Like, it's for real. And so all this, like, those were the takeaways. Like, we would ask people, so what does this commercial say to you? Because we, you know, tested out with consumers and focus groups before we'd actually air them. And, you know, at least the storyboards and stuff. And people would go, wow, you know, this says these things to me. And we're like, okay, we've done our job. So it was really, that was extremely gratifying. I mean, the agency did a really great job of coming up with, you know, all those things. But it was kind of like, it took a lot of marketing thought up front to recognize, like, what were the pain points, what were the challenges, what were some possible, you know, pitfalls or traps, like, the name is great, but it could be a problem. And, you know, what are the things that will really stand out, you know? So that was some of the thinking behind it.
Are you also keeping in mind at the same time in your branding efforts that you need to convince businesses that the web is a viable place to advertise, that Yahoo is a viable place to advertise?
Absolutely. And so, you know, you can imagine that my job internally wasn't always easy, because I'd have to convince people that, like, hey, rather than hiring more engineers or rather than getting, you know, more servers or getting a larger office space so that we aren't, you know, four of us sharing one desk, you know, hey, we really should spend this money on advertising. And they'd be like, well, Karen, so what can you get us for that advertising? And they're like, and I'm like, well, I don't, you know, how many more new users can you get? And I'm like, well, how many users do we have? You know, and it's like, nobody, you know, we didn't know, right? So it's like, you know, trying to project out, like, what's the ROI on our advertising was pretty tough, right? It was pretty much impossible to do. But, you know, we were getting, you know, the company was getting ready to go public. Because of SEC rulings and stuff like that, we didn't want to try to hype the stock, you know, before, you know, going public. So we were careful not to, like, I wanted, for instance, to switch PR agencies. We did not switch PR agencies during that time. We didn't do anything out of the ordinary course of running the business. So we couldn't do anything that was going to be any big, gigantic, crazy splash. But what we did do is, I'm going to answer the question about advertisers, but I'm also going to talk about what it meant to try to appeal to Wall Street.
Right,
so again, here's this company with people who our business cards say that we're like Chief Yahoo and, Marketing Yahoo or whatever. Our logo on our business card is not the same as the logo on the screen. We have purple and blue on the, purple and yellow and blue on the card. We have red on the screen. I mean, we look like amateurs, right? But, we did have a really strong CEO, strong CFO, strong, COO. We had, I did have some experience. I wasn't, completely a novice. We had a head of sales and head of international. These are all people who had real business experience prior to coming to Yahoo. So, I think really Wall Street was investing in the overall space, the industry, and they were willing to invest in Yahoo partly because we did have that kind of team and we did have this idea about building a brand. Like we were telling Wall Street that we're going to build a brand and that we had some tools in place and some thoughts and some things that we were doing that showed that we were doing that. And we were, for instance, we were developing market research and working with market research companies to do that. And so we created a video as part of our roadshow, which now like everybody does, right? But in those days, tech companies basically had, the top executives go and have closed doors meetings with bankers and investors, blah, 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 same old, same old. But we actually put together, in addition to the PowerPoint presentation, a video, and I hired a guy that I'd worked with in advertising and who used to make movie trailers and video trailers with me at 20th Century Fox. So it had a different, style and sense, and it was really appealing. And it made us look professional. It made us look professional, but it was exciting. I think we generated a lot of excitement for the company, but we looked professional and we looked like we had an important story to tell. And so I think that made a big difference. So we convinced Wall Street. We had an amazing IPO. That was all great. But Xcite was a company that went public before us, and these other companies all went public right at about the same time. So it wasn't just, Netscape had gone public the year before, and it's been the biggest IPO ever, blah, 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 or whatever. But they didn't have a brand. It's kind of like you go public, and that's all people know about you is your stock. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens when your stock goes down? Then that's all people are going to talk about. So we knew we had to have something else to talk about besides our stock. And so that was one of the reasons I was able to convince the team at Yahoo that, we did need to invest in advertising and that it was worth a try. And the other thing, the argument I tried to make, is that we were in the business of selling advertising. So, good brands, if we want Pepsi and Procter & Gamble and Johnson & Johnson to experiment and test out internet advertising, they would rather be with a brand that they think has, trust and consumer awareness like Yahoo than they would just one of these other, techie brands or techie companies that have no real brand affinity amongst consumers. So that was another argument that I would try to make a lot, in order to try to, get a budget or be able to hire people, to help do the stuff that I thought would be fun to do and that I thought would, create results. So,
delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
To that end, actually, how much is there a sense of the competition with, you know, the Excites and the Lycoses, and, you know, because Excite kind of they get into branding as well, and they have their Are You Experienced and stuff like that. But how much was there a sense in for you or internally at Yahoo of like this Coke versus Pepsi thing of keeping Yahoo number one, you know, not a search engine, it was a directory, but, you know, the site that people would go to first on the web.
Yeah, I think this is where having a brand, when you're really clear on what your brand values are, which is what we did, like, you know, we did a brand guidelines, you know, sort of brand guidelines. We had a brand mission. We had a clear mission for the company. At one point, I actually invited in a priest who I knew. I don't happen to be Catholic, but I brought in a guy who I know who's a priest, and we talked about. I sat down with Jerry and David and a couple of executive team members, and we said, you know, what does this company really stand for? Like, you know, once the stock, you know, stock price and the this and that, when it's all said and done, like, what do we really stand for? What do we really care about? What do we want people to know about us, you know, with? And so I think that when you have a clear, you know, our feeling was we felt that every person had the right to good information, and that was something we wanted to deliver upon. And so then we had a bunch of things about what our brand was and what our brand was not. And, like, so for instance, one of the things I said is, you know, at Yahoo, we're never going to describe ourselves as cool. We're never going to say, hey, check out this cool thing on Yahoo. And I hate to say it, but I'm kind of sad that got lost at Yahoo somewhere along the way long after I'd been gone. I mean, the company's 20 years old now, so of course these things change and evolve. But I think it's kind of sad that got lost. You know, it's like I always felt like if you have to say you're cool, you're not really cool. You know, like let the person feel you're cool. And if they don't, then that's, you know, whatever. So anyway, so I think we were extremely worried about the competition from a business standpoint. So we were aggressive about how do we grow? How do we continue to innovate? How do we make sure we're really delivering on our promise and our brand? How do we stay true to our brand and stick authentic to our brand? And I think because we had done that work, then when there were different points of decision to be made, we didn't we knew which paths to take. Like we were never confused about what to do, which I think was really useful. It doesn't mean that we always made the right decisions, but we were able to make decisions fairly quickly and be decisive, and so everything was consistent. And I remember, you know, we would talk to the press, you know, quite often. We had very good a very good PR team internally. I believed early on that we should invest in internal folks, and so we had some amazing people internally doing PR. And we would get reporters, you know, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, you know, all people from around the world, and they would talk to the executive team, and they would be like, wow, you know, I've never interviewed companies where everyone is on the same page so consistently. You know, no matter who I talk to, you guys are all saying the same thing. You guys are all rowing in the same direction. And I think that's, you know, that was a real key. And I believe that having a brand, like when you're clear on your business mission and your brand is really consistent with that, that can be extremely powerful.
And you mentioned early on that right away there was a lot of international expansion and things like that. So was it difficult to translate that into the overseas expansion, or were you able to, was the brand basically the same everywhere you took it?
Yeah, you're bringing up that's a really important question. It was a question that I grappled with a lot because, you know, it was like my first time being a brand steward, you know, being the person, you know, kind of trying to guide and nurture a brand and help build it. And so it was my first time. And so, you know, having like the Harvard MBA background in my head, trying to make sense of it and trying to figure out like, okay, you know, what are some examples of great brands out there that I could follow? And who, you know, where do I get some lessons, you know, and learn on my feet? And I was really humbled by this. Like I was like, oh my God, you know, this feels really daunting to make this, to help, to try to make this decision, because they're, you know, global brands. There are two different, you know, there's kind of two main kinds of ways to think about a global brand. A brand like Disney means the same thing everywhere in the world. You know, Disney is the same. They sometimes hire, like, you know, a different actress to do the voice of a character than they do, you know, rather than just, you know, they don't just, you know, subtitle or whatever, dub. But, you know, it really is the same brand everywhere. Coca-Cola is not the same brand everywhere. It's really different. And refreshment means different things in different places. In some places, Coke is a luxury. In some cases, Coke represents America. In some places, Coke is, you know, it represents what you have with pizza or whatever. Coke means different, and different brand. You know, Coca-Cola has different brands, right? You know, the orange and the Sprite and the whatever else. Mm-hmm. They don't sell all the different brands every place, right? And the formulas are different and everything. But, you know, it's a hugely successful global brand, right? So I was thinking, I struggled with, well, how, what should we be? Should we be, if, you know, really tailored to each local, you know, community and each local country, or should we stand for the same things everywhere, right? And the same values everywhere. And I definitely felt like I was out of my, you know, pay grade, out of my depth in making this decision, or, you know, guiding this decision. Clearly, there were business reasons that drove it as well, so I don't want to make it sound like this was just my decision or anything. It certainly was not. But, you know, there were business things, like, for instance, you know, Tim Brady and the team and everybody recognized it was super, you know, it was very important for people to have, to be able to log in no matter where they were in the world and, you know, get the things they wanted to get and all that. So that was really key. But we made sure that every, like, all the content in each country was really valuable for that country. So, you know, in Japan, of course, the news and the sports and finance and everything would all be what was relevant for the Japanese audience. But in terms of what the brand values were, like what the identification was and how it looked and felt, we wanted that to be the same around the world. And I think that I think that was the right call. I think that pretty much I can't think of any internet companies that became successful that didn't do that. I can think of a bunch of them that did not do it, that we don't know, that nobody has heard of today because they don't exist anymore because they failed. But the ones that all worked, that have been successful, have done the same thing. So. Now it seems obvious. I guess at the time it did not seem so obvious.
Well, you know, I've spoken to several of the Excite people, some Lycos people, Alta Vista, and, you know, when I would ask them, well, how come Yahoo won? You know, because they would say, well, you know, we really had superior technology and this and that and the other thing, but they would all come back to that Yahoo was the successful portal, the successful search site of the .com era because they just, everyone knew them. It was the branding. To a person, I think they all said that it was the branding that they couldn't overcome that kept Yahoo at the top. So I'm encouraging you now to pat yourself on the back. But do you agree that that was the key for Yahoo's success in terms of overcoming the other, you know, search competitors and such?
I do, but I mean, not because I was involved in doing it, but because I mean, just as a marketer, I believe in brands, but I think a brand is more than just, you know, the awareness or the advertising or, you know, the logo and all that. It's also, your brand is, I mean, it's the promise you have with your users, but our engineering and our product team and, you know, the content creators, everyone delivered on that promise. Right. So it may not have been that we had always the you know, the fastest technology, if you will, or the most cutting edge technology, but it was the smartest use of the technology to deliver on the promise that we had with our consumers. So I think all those parts of the company, that it all worked together in order to deliver on that, on a promise that I think was the right promise. Yeah. So, but you know, back to the name, one thing I was afraid you were about to tell me was that, oh, you know, Lycos and Excite and all these people. Well, the reason that Yahoo did better is because, I mean, the name, right? I mean, how easy was it? The name, like people say, oh, Karen, wow, you know, you're lucky you had such a great name to work with. And it was like, yeah, I do feel lucky. That's why I called them first. I called Yahoo, not these other guys. But, you know, the name could have been a disaster. You know, the name is difficult to pronounce in a lot of countries. The name doesn't mean anything in other languages. So it could have been horrible. It could have, in fact, meant something weird, which we were completely afraid of. That was, like, one of the first things I did is, like, you know, started looking up to see, like, you know, what does this mean in other languages, you know? And it was like, oh, thank God, you know. And it wasn't a huge, gigantic problem. But it could have been, right? And you know, the name initially, like nowadays, it's almost hard to believe. But in those days, people are like, what, Yahoo? Are those like these hacker guys? Wait, is a Yahoo a hacker? I mean, that's what people were asking, you know? So in hindsight, it's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, that was easy. We you know, caught a wave, and Yahoo was a great name. But it wasn't, you know, it could have not necessarily have been, you know, a great thing. But I think it was. I mean, I in my heart, I felt like it was going to be, and I clearly saw that lots of other people felt the same way, for sure. But, yeah, we had to make sure people could take us seriously and trust us, right? Because imagine once, for instance, like people would say, I remember when we were getting ready to launch Yahoo Mail, and we're like, should we call it something else? Like, should, you know, I was like, oh, no, you've got to be able to be Brian at Yahoo.com. You've got to be able to do that. That's our best advertising ever, right? We have to.
Right,
have
right.
Like, yeah, but, like, are people going to want to be a Yahoo? Like, will they want to be a Yahoo? Will people go, like, Yahoo? Like, is that, like, is your email going to be safe? You know, can we trust it? You know, like, those are the kinds of things people are asking in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like, okay, yeah, we got to make sure that, like, trust, you know, trust and reliability. And I think that was another reason why I never wanted us to describe ourselves as cool. Like, you know, let people, you know, let's just say that we're trustworthy and reliable, you know, and let other people think we're cool. You know, let people think we're cool, but let's say we're trustworthy and reliable. So
before we wrap up here, I if you could just, some of the people that we've been talking about that you worked with, just give us a few words of your impression working with them, their roles in the company, that sort of thing. So let's start with Jerry Yang.
Sure. So Jerry, from the time I first met him, he's an amazing guy. I mean, he was obviously a lot younger now than he is now. He's been a CEO of the company as well. But yeah, what I always appreciate about Jerry is that he's a really humble guy, and he was always interested in talking to anyone who was interested. Like, see, he never, like, put himself above other people in the company or consumers or people at trade shows. I remember the first time I traveled with Jerry and David, we went to an internet convention, Internet World in New York, and Jerry and David shared a hotel room, you know, because it was like, they were like, yeah, we just don't want to spend a lot of money, you know, from the company. It's like, we're a publicly traded company, and they shared a hotel room. You know, because they just wanted to, like, not spend money, which I thought was great. And I was like, okay, guys, but I'm not sharing a hotel room with you. but they, you know, like, that sort of thing, you know. And then, like, at Christmas time, Jerry and David, with their own money, bought Christmas presents for all the employees. Things like, you know, a Yahoo sleeping bag or a really cool messenger bag, or, you know, things that were, like cool, fun things that people could take home and use at home. So yeah, they were great, like really good, like high integrity, caring, thoughtful people, and wickedly smart. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, do the same for Jeff Mallett and Tim Kugel.
Sure. So TK is someone who I stay in touch with a lot. I actually see him maybe a couple times a year. He's an amazing guy. He was a little bit of a reluctant hero. He was not always very comfortable. You know, he doesn't really, at least in those, at the beginning, was not all that excited about doing a lot of public speaking. He was fine, you know, of course, doing deals and negotiating and working with Wall Street and convincing Wall Street of the potential of the company and doing all that. And he's great. But I think initially he wasn't like we would have like announcements for the company. I was like, TK, you know, come on, you know, let's go out in front of the whole company and talk about what, you know, the results of the quarter and really like, you know, get people energized. And people loved it. Like, the employees loved him, like, because he was so like normal, right? And he would walk around, he'd just walk and just be like, he would just act normal, like in a great, approachable, wonderful way, you know? And so he became a hero to everyone, but he wasn't like seeking that out. He was never like, oh, I'm going to be like someone that we all look up to, you know, that the employees all look up to. He never tried to do that. It just happened in a very natural, organic way. It was, at Yahoo, we would all dress up for Halloween. And I think some Halloween, everybody on my team, all the marketing people, we all dressed up as Tim Kugel. And it was hilarious. And he, you know, like he was like so shy, like he was so embarrassed by it, you know. He was just like such a great guy. The other thing I loved about him was that he knew what he knew and he knew what he didn't know so much. And so a lot of CEOs, they really try to micromanage, particularly advertising and anything with creative. And TK was like, look, you know, I have a PhD in engineering. I don't watch TV. I don't know about this stuff. He's like, give it a try. But then once he saw the results, he was like, hey, keep it up, you know, just keep doing the job. So he never like tried to get involved in, you know, the minutia of what we were doing or anything. It was great. And then Jeff Mallett,
yeah, sorry.
Isn't me. Do you have time?
Oh yeah. No, please.
Okay. So Jeff, was my boss and, you know, I worked really closely with him, but you know, he also had all the other functional heads reporting to him. Sales, business development, all the operations, everything. So, he was a very busy guy. The guy probably worked harder in the company than just about, I would say, anyone. Ton of energy. The guy just has like a ton of energy. And he was very, very good too in international. He had a lot of international experience. He hired an amazing woman to run international named Heather Killen. And so he was great at attracting good talent. And but I have to say, like, I mean, he was a good manager, but he didn't spend a lot of his time managing, you know, like, meaning I think he hired people that he thought could do a good job and he trusted them to do that job. And so everybody, you know, if I had something I needed to go to him on, I went to him, and obviously, you know, he'd come in checking on me or whatever. But I found that he was definitely the kind of manager who just needed to hire good people, and then, like, you know, he found good people, and then he gave them, you know, the tools and resources to do their job. And so he and Tim Kugel and Jerry Yang were really the strategic visionaries of the company and the deal makers and the drivers. So everything kind of had the three of them in their involvement on everything, you know, in terms of anything big, you know, acquisitions, the strategy, the direction, where the company was going. You know, that was really, you know, they all worked on those things very closely together. We call them the three amigos.
You leave Yahoo in 2001, I think, and looking at bios, a lot of the early people sort of all leave around the same time. So I'm curious, was there a burnout, or it had to be a wild couple of years, a real wild ride to go from, you know, a nothing to, you know, tens of thousands of employees was there anything like that? Like, you know, by 2000, 2001, maybe people just needed a break?
You know, I think a lot of people, I think we all had very, you know, high work ethics and, you know, strong work ethics. And I think, you know, I was a little bit older than some of the folks who were there. So Jeff Mallett's actually a couple of years younger than I am and two of the other people are. And so I had like my first child. I was ready to kind of slow down a little bit. But it was also a real change in the culture because we had a new CEO. Terry Semel.
Right, right.
And I really think that that had more to do with it, which was actually a change in the industry, which was kind of, you know, unfortunate. We're starting to realize that we needed to do some new things and take on some new directions, which I think we're fine. Like, I think a lot of the people on the team would have been fine with moving into some new directions. That would have been okay. But I think it was a different culture. Terry was a much more of a corporate-style CEO.
And he came from Hollywood, too, right?
Exactly, yeah. I'd worked in Hollywood. I kind of knew what that was about. We had a couple other people who also came from the media and entertainment world, and so kind of knew what that was like. And, you know, I think, you know, there were a couple people who were brought in kind of, you know, under Terry that... where there was some culture clash. I mean, that's what it was, you know, for me. I'm not sure, you know, for everybody else. But, I think each person had their own, you know, their own reason, you know. On one hand, I said I was a little bit older than some of the folks, but there were actually, like, the head of sales, the head of... our CFO, a couple people like that had left before I did. And I think it was partly they had sacrificed so much in terms of being away from their families and you know, just, you know, the round-the-clock, 24/7, always-on job. That I do think that maybe for some of the folks who left before me, before the culture clash really had started to happen, I think it was, you know, they maybe probably were starting to feel that way. Yeah.
So I will wrap up by asking what you're up to now. But before I do that, if you'll indulge me in one sort of big question here, because you still work with brands and stuff today, is it night and day difference from what you did at Yahoo? Like now in the era of social, of mobile, of today?
Yeah. I mean, talk about luck, right? I mean, when we did what we were doing, it was still at a time when, you know, people would talk about, you know, advertising campaigns. I mean, you could, you know, you would hear people describe, you know, they watched TV, you know, they listened to the radio, they, you know, read magazines and all that. And so, you know, advertising, a lot of advertising in those days was still, you know, kind of more intrusive. So, I mean, that's just advertising, but also just the ability to do PR, the ability to create a vision and to about what you stood for. You know, there were a lot of things that were easier in those days. I mean, that being said, it was a lot harder to find your audience. The power of the internet today is that you can really find your audience and you can have distinct messages to distinct audiences. So in a way, it's also the golden era of marketing, right? You know, we probably could have, you know, I mean, we're an internet company, so it's kind of hard to, you know, there was no way to be online to get to who we needed to reach. But, you know, with brands today, you know, there is that opportunity, which is great. You know, the other thing is today, you know, things can be spread much more rapidly because of social media. And because of, you know, sharing, and so that's really great too. So that's one of the things that still makes it very interesting for me, and why I still enjoy marketing, and I still enjoy helping to develop new brands, is because there's so many more tools in the toolkit for a marketer nowadays. So that's pretty exciting. But yeah, it was easier to do what we did then than it would be now. Hmm. I mean, you couldn't do the exact. Easier, harder, So, everybody was curious, right? It was like, what is this internet thing? So, we had an answer for that.
Yeah, that was such a fascinating answer. I hadn't thought about that. Like, you were still in an era when, okay, how do we reach people? Buy TV ads,
or radio, or
right, yeah,
reach them outdoor, you know, like with these amazing billboards that, you know, people would see, and, you know, neon billboards and these really iconic places in San Francisco and New York and Sunset Boulevard, and be like, whoa, that's cool, you know. And I think there was also an element of people, we got noticed because they thought of us as, we were a virtual brand, right? So people kind of were curious, like, what does Yahoo look like, you know? What does a Yahoo look like? What, when people would see us in the real world, it would be like, wow, you know, this thing that they just see on their computer screen has now come to life. So that would get people's attention as well.
Well, you've been so generous with your time, so I do want to let you go. But if you want to tell us anything about what you're up to today, you still seem busy. So whatever you want.
So basically what I do is I work with typically, you know, founders of companies or companies they're trying to get off the ground, and I help them think through, like, what is their brand and what's their brand promise, and, you know, what do they want to deliver on and their mission and what do they really stand for. And I help them think about how to acquire users and members. I also work with consumer brands that want to learn more about the internet and making sure that they're doing things that are going to be attractive to today's internet audiences. So, at the end of the day, I think of myself as a brand builder or brand, you know, developer, and also sometimes, I guess, like a little bit of a consumer advocate. I also helped, I was part of a team that started an organization called Common Sense Media, and we've been around for, I guess, about 12, 13 years now, and we are dedicated to helping families figure out the media landscape. And a lot of our work has been, you know, in the last, you know, however many years, is helping families make sense of social media and thinking about screen time and thinking about healthy habits and using the internet. And then we also have TV and movie reviews and all kinds of things that help parents make informed decisions and teachers for their children. So that's been pretty near and dear to my heart because I also have two kids. So, yeah.
Well, Karen Edwards, that was all fascinating stuff. Like, I loved all of that. Thank you so much for coming on the show and remembering all that for us.
Sure. It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod. And my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.